Here we are. Monday, July 24th, brought to you by TechGC. This is the Data Protection Breakfast Club. Our guest is Amy Stewart, the GC at LiveRamp. We've known Amy a little while. She's brilliant. She's a force. Fun conversation. Massive tech company with huge, huge data privacy issues. And we didn't touch on many of them, actually.
Which is the best, honestly, man. Like, we can go see her work product out there, and it's great and it's excellent. I just like that she's an OG and been around a long time and seen all the things.
Yeah, I love the way she talks about, like, the depth to which she's the outside counsel for the client. I don't think you see this anymore, like, where somebody is really and truly not just, like, your outside counsel that you have on a list of firms that you've pre-vetted and they've all signed the same engagement letter. No, it's like, this is our outside counsel who we've trusted for many years, understands our business, litigated cases for us. You're going to be in our strategy meetings. And oh, by the way, now you should, you know, please come be our GC.
Just be here. Yeah, you should be here. You know, I love that we had a conversation we've had on the podcast a few times about, like, the new way of coming to work and, you know, remote versus in person and distributed versus concentrated, whatever. And, like, you, everyone's heard my viewpoint on this, which I'm a big fan of distributed work. I think it's a great equalizer, whatever. But her litigator came out and we had a great discussion about, like the counterpoints to my theory. And I love that because I think, like, challenging my own notions as by somebody as smart as she is really good. I still think I'm right, but I definitely need to think carefully about some of the things that she mentioned as sort of the trade-offs, which, because I think she's right. There are trade-offs. There is no panacea way to do that. And we'll probably spend, you know, the next few years trying to figure out what the right balance is for, like, how people show up to work. But I love that part of the conversation because there is no actual right answer. It's like you said, it's like art, not science, to figure out how we optimize the workforce going forward.
Can I ask you a separate question before we go to the conversation?
Yeah.
What do you think about Twitter's new name X?
Dude, well, I posted on Threads today for anyone who wants to read my thoughts on the name X. But, you know, I mean, obviously we're the competition and, like, I don't want to get into the, like, Meta versus Twitter thing, but, like, I am not an Elon Musk fan and has nothing to do with my job. And I think he has taken what really functioned as a town square space for Earth, where in real time you could track things that are happening. Like, I remember, you know, I worked for the Biden campaign this last presidential election cycle. And, like, I sat in a room in Miami at an Airbnb, and Twitter is what I used to, like, track the election in real time. Yeah. All these experts and all the things. And, you know, you can see from all viewpoints, all the analysis on the election, like, second by second, minute by minute. And Twitter's space in, like, the world was that. When a real-time event is happening in the world, everyone turned to Twitter to see how, like, it was playing out. That function of Twitter, people could argue, still exists, but it's such a toxic place with no identity now, especially since it's literally called X, that, like, I worry that that role that Twitter played, that no other social media platform played in the same way, is destroyed. And I thought that was an extremely important piece of online activity that I hope either Threads or some other platform can sort of take the helm on. Because it's just important, man.
Yeah.
It's important.
I think it's interesting to think about it from the context of, like, I guess maybe he's just creating something different. Like, I don't like it. I mean, I'll be like, you don't have to be clear about it. I will. I don't like it. I don't like X. I don't like him. So, like,
this is a crappy branding.
It's like really bad. It's like comically bad. So I guess, and I totally agree. I got into Twitter when it was years ago. There was a real time event and I was following. I was like, oh, this is the best way to follow the real time.
This is the best way to follow.
But man, like, unless their desire is to build something totally different, maybe it is, but, like, you're right. That function of
what happens to that thing. Yeah. What happens to that thing? And that's to me, the scariest part of all of this. You know, if you read the comms about this announcement around X, it's like, oh, you know, they want to be I'm paraphrasing, but it's basically, we want to be a one-stop shop app for everything. And, like, you know, Google tried that. Meta tried that. It didn't work. Okay. Like, we've tried. Other companies have tried to be the everything app. And one place that it's worked is in China with WeChat, mm-hmm. which is really an everything mm-hmm. app. But it also functions as a tremendous, like, surveillance apparatus for the Chinese government. Yeah. So, like, it's been successful there because the government has sort of forced the issue. He's not going to have that support here.
Yeah.
So, like, I don't know where that thing is going, man. But, like,
time will tell.
It's sad to see such a prestige brand, which Twitter was. It really was. To sort of now just be a X. I don't know, man.
X.
An X.
We'll see what happens. It's now an X. I'll tell you who's not. Amy. Amy is the best. All right. So
should we pronounce it X or 10?
Let's talk to Amy instead. All right. Here we are. We're the back 40 with Amy Stewart, GC at LiveRamp. Welcome. Yeah. We did it.
Thank you.
We're here. We had some tech trouble last week. I was all messed up. You were all messed up. Nothing was working, but it looks like we're on track right now.
I thought we were jinxed, so I hope it's over.
We made it.
Oh, man.
All right. So explain the back 40. You're in a beautiful place. Where are you? And we see birds chirping. I feel like a toucan is going to come in and just, like, rest behind you.
Nothing so exotic. I live in the far land, the very tip of Cape Cod. And we're just up in the woods at the house.
Beautiful.
In this fabulous little sun porch that we had made by the most wonderful Amish craftsman.
Well, that looked really how interesting.
Yes, it's my favorite place in the whole.
Well, it looks beautiful, and like the trees back there look mature and plush. And
we're so lucky.
I feel like if you have a security incident, you know, at your company, like I would want to move myself to that location so that I could like kind of breathe and work through it.
Okay. Well, you don't know. Actually, I randomly look up and see that my husband has these cameras everywhere. Like,
oh no.
You're right. You would think that, you know, married to me for 40 years, he would know better than to do this to privacy, but he says he's protecting me. Well, everywhere I go, there are cameras.
How protected do you feel by the cameras? Like if a robber came in, do you think the cameras would defend you?
They would. The thing is, Cape Cod is about the safest place on earth. At least
that was my next question, a large home invasion scene up there in Cape Cod.
I shouldn't be saying this publicly, but I don't even know when there was a crime. We truly live on the national seashore, surrounded by the national seashore and the and conservation woods. Anybody who's going to get here really can't get out fast.
What's incredible to me, and I see this all the time. I'll be at a privacy conference, and you know, I work at Meta. People will always make their comments about, you know everything about me, blah, 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 whatever. We know the narrative. And at that, like, I've been at dinner tables, at conference dinners, where it's like, yeah, the social media companies are getting us all. And then it's like, let me show you some videos of this thing my dog is doing while I'm out of town. And they open up their phone, and it's like 15 surveillance cameras in their house and 25 different sensors, you know, like, all that stuff's getting shared with all these corporations too. And to me, I refuse to put a camera inside my home. I have a doorbell camera. I turn off all the police sharing stuff because I'm not with any of that stuff. But I live in this beautiful like townhome community, and we have this courtyard. And if I stand in the middle of the courtyard, and I've done this many times, if I stand in the middle of the courtyard, there are 9 cameras pointed at me. 9. 9.
You're safe.
That's insane.
Yeah.
That's insane to me.
It is. But what I would say, actually, I don't know what system this is. It's not like there's no connection to Google or Siri or anything. We don't have that. So I don't know where this is recording to. They are in the doors. I don't think can see me. They're into the doors. And my husband really does believe it's for safety. And he really is one of these people who every time there's some new technology, he wants to participate in it. And I'm like to the farthest extreme on the other side. And so
Well, so you made a reference, Amy, to, you know, him not doing this to a privacy professional, privacy lawyer. But I think my thought was that you had so many years of your career not necessarily doing privacy. So when did the switch flip? You know, like, because you were a litigator for a long time. So can you go back a little bit? This is a perfect segue into like how someone goes from being a litigator to, I think, arguably dealing with some of the most complex privacy issues there are at LiveRamp, which, for those that don't know, it's pretty data heavy company.
ad tech is, I think, probably the hardest privacy. I will give you that. And I came from a route that I don't think anybody else could ever claim. I was outside counsel for litigation counsel for Axiom for many, many, many years. And then my daughter, Patsy Balin, came along and was really interested in privacy. She did her Weston Fellowship. This would have been in roughly 2016, I think. And then, as I recall, got a call from Jennifer Barrett Glasgow. I don't know if any of you know her. She was, you know, a founding mother of privacy and chief privacy officer. She may have been the first woman in the country, and she was amazing. She was at Axiom at the time. And Jennifer asked her if she wanted to come and be the, I guess, I don't know what the title was at the time, head of privacy at LiveRamp. And Patsy was very excited about that. It was in San Francisco. So she went and did it. And I started to come to the privacy meetings at Axiom just to watch Patsy. I mean, just because I thought it was so cool to see my own daughter being so smart. And like, I came to understand why fathers want their sons to join the business, because I got to see Patsy, you know, three or four times a week. Be brilliant. I thought she's brilliant. She's my daughter. She is brilliant.
And let me verify. I've met her and worked with her. She is brilliant. So separate and apart from being your daughter, I don't believe if I met her at Axiom or Safegraph or one of the other companies, but your daughter's in the privacy scene for a long time as well.
Yeah. And so that's how I just started to watch, and I did know Jennifer Barrett before that, and she is amazing as well. I mean, truly amazing. So I would just go to the privacy meetings, and in my capacity as outside counsel, I had a pretty broad view and access, and I would just go to the Monday meetings.
That's such a novel. Did you have active litigation at the time? I mean, like, to me, it's a bit of a novel concept to bring your outside counsel to a privacy meeting. Yeah. You know, it's interesting.
I was pretty well embedded. Whoops. What happened? Can you guys hear me?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I just lost the image. I'm going to do this without the image, okay? I was pretty well embedded at Axiom and really, you know, kind of knew people and had an overview on things, and that was intentional, you know, made people more comfortable with me. To a lot of people, I kind of looked like inside counsel almost. So that's why I went. I mean, I'm sure I must have asked Jennifer if it was okay, and she must have said yes. And we had maybe some peripheral privacy stuff, but most of the time I was there just listening.
You guys, if I needed to do that, Pedro, do you bring outside, like, at any, and not just Meta, other companies, you bring outside counsel into like strategy meetings?
Very rarely. But I have.
Yeah.
It's just, they're too expensive.
I was cheap. I was from Arkansas. And I marvel now, even today, at how little I charged for what
that,
I did.
That question didn't even occur to me to ask you that. And now I'm really interested in it. Like, you've got your billable rate, you know, back when you were doing your thing. And now you've got someone that's like, yeah, I'm a steal at $1,100 an hour. Like, are you crazy?
Absolutely crazy. When I left private practice, and I've been at one firm for 30 years, loved it. It was fabulous. You know, we were in Little Rock and produced, I absolutely believe, world-class work. at Little Rock prices. And so I did so much work for Axiom, and really by the time I left, I was probably just working for three clients. I really narrowed it down, but I did a ton of work for those, and really liked the part about being really integrated with them. I think my rate may have been $450 an hour.
I love that.
And I mean, we knew it was discounted. In fact, Jerry Jones, who, at Axiom, who's the one who always hired me and had been a partner at the Rose firm until like 1998, had been my partner. He used to say all the time, like, will you please just go over to, go to Wilson Sonsini. You can make three times as much. We'll still use you all the time. And it would just, it would be better for you. But I absolutely adored the Rose firm, and I would not leave. And I was fine. It was such a special place.
Interesting how that works loyalty-wise. I given all the layoffs we've seen in the last 12 months all over the place, including law firms, I wonder if that type of sentiment is of a bygone era, right? Because I look at the new generation of lawyers specifically, and this idea of like, I'm going to crank out at a firm for a long time, pay off, build some sort of brand and then go. I think it's sort of different now. I think it's like, I go to a firm if I have to, but I'm looking to do something more interesting as soon as I can. That is like the general sentiment I get from students that I interact with and teach. And it wasn't even like that when I graduated, which was in when the hell did I graduate from law school? 2008-ish.
Pedro,
right?
Is that a function of privacy? Like, are you talking about privacy students? Because
I'm talking in general. I'm talking in general. Yeah. I mean, I think in the privacy space, I don't know. You tell me. But the coolest work is inside corporations. I don't know.
That's what I'm getting at.
Yeah.
Well, for sure, that's the case with privacy or tech companies. But do you think that's true outside our industry?
Not sure. Yeah. Not sure.
I think we may be in a bit of a vacuum.
I think it's true. I think it's true in outside of, if you say our industry, whether we're talking about ads and marketing specific or data companies, or whether you're talking about privacy writ large, like in healthcare or in finance.
Yeah.
I think probably there's a lot of opportunity in those verticals too. And our mutual friend Scott Lashway and I have this back and forth about which, where there's more complexity, ad tech versus healthcare. He thinks it's in both, but he thinks healthcare skews more technically privacy complicated. But, he's not right about that. Actually, it's ad tech. And so on that point, how long did it take you? If you're litigating outside, right? One of the great things about litigators that dive in really deeply is they got to understand the business in order to litigate your case. So was that how you sort of felt like, all right, I'm going to make the leap and I already understand a lot of this stuff already? Learning curve with everything, but was that your thinking?
I understood more of the offline world because of Axiom than the online world. I think, as with so many things, I basically took the leap without really understanding or thinking. I was ready for a change. I was getting cranky, and I knew it wasn't the firm and it wasn't my clients, so it had to be me. It just, like, I was maybe on the edge of burnout before burnout was a burnout, and this came along and it really just fell in my lap, and I just did it, because it was different.
You do it, and then Axiom is spun off. So, like,
well,
tell us the order. Yes. Yeah, so I get this wrong. So tell us the order. You've got Axiom and LiveRamp. You tell us the story here, because
LiveRamp spun Axiom off to IPG, kept a couple of the core assets, kept Axiom as its a very, very large customer, but went off on its own and had to rebuild everything. So, LiveRamp hadn't had a lot of its own support functions. It hadn't had a lot of separate systems. And so went from, in October of 2018, with the split, we had maybe, 250 people. and within a year had to get to 1,000 or 1,200. So it was a huge rebuilding and expansion.
So you'd been the outside counsel for Axiom, and then all of a sudden you have to be the GC of LiveRamp, which is interesting.
Well, I came in as chief privacy officer. And then, so I came in May. The split was in October. I came in February, I'm sorry, as the chief privacy officer. And then Vanessa Wu left in May, and I took over as general counsel as well. So then I had both of them. And it actually was easier once I was general counsel as well, because I, you know, saw everything. But it was, as you say, you just learn. It was very like litigation. I had this huge advantage of knowing people already, both from when I had done all the work for Axiom. And you know, when LiveRamp was part of Axiom, I also did LiveRamp's litigation. So I had met lots of people. And then I had Patsy, who had already left LiveRamp. And I wouldn't have had to come if she were there. So she had left LiveRamp, I don't know, a year or 18 months earlier. And but she had all these friends. She had come when LiveRamp was very tiny, right after the acquisition, but you know, she was like the 100th employee or something like that. I mean, it was very tiny. And so she really knew everybody, and she gave me a crash course in what I needed. And then there were a couple of, well, everybody was great about answering my questions. And I, because I had this history where a lot of people knew me and I did know, you know, the company pretty well, even though I didn't know the, you know, the products, the details of the technology, I knew enough that I you know, kind of had a honeymoon of credibility that let me do, you know, let me get my foot in the door. And people were terrific about answering questions. But also I had, there was one fellow who had kind of covered until I got there for about, I don't know, a couple months in privacy. And one of the I made a few conditions in order to come, and one of them was that he stay for 6 months. And he was like, he was products fixer. You know, like if there's a problem, he would get assigned to it. He just could solve problems. And so I asked that he stay for 6 months, and he did, and he taught me everything. It was incredible.
This is a non-lawyer product person.
Non-lawyer, yeah. Non-privacy person. And it wasn't that he taught me any privacy stuff. It's that he taught me the business, and he taught me how to be in a business, because I had had 30 years in a law firm. My view of business was so different. You know, it's so different than being inside the business. And he was like God's gift
to me.
This
is such a, I want to double click on this. Like, this is such an important point in every job I've ever had, and I want to be a percentage of that for somebody else, you know, when they join, whatever my slice of the world is, I've got to give that to you, because this stuff is so complicated. Not just ad tech, it is, but like when I joined DataXu, Tom Flanagan and this guy Mishka Surilov, right? Like, they walked me through everything multiple times. Like, Tom was from an account management campaign perspective. Here's how we run the platform. Here's how campaigns work. Here's how we, you know, acquire customers. And Mishka was the head, you know, the VP of engineering. So walking me through like how we built what we built. I can't like echo that point you made enough, that you've got to have champions like that and people that will give you the knowledge. So much.
Yep, he was incredible. His name is Venky Natarajan, and he was, and he's still there. He taught me such basic things, like this is what a product manager does. He said, at LiveRamp, at Axiom, maybe everywhere, privacy and legal are service teams, and they get so used to like basically turning the other cheek. You need something done, fine, we'll figure out how to do it. It didn't matter that it wasn't legal or it wasn't data ethics. And I, you know, that was the model I knew. And so that's what I did when I got there. And he would sometimes say, why are you in this meeting? Or why are you doing this? You don't have time for this. This isn't your job. It's this group's job. And I would say, because it's our job to help. That's why we do. He said, you're actually hurting the other group. You're disempowering them. That is bad for them. It's bad for them personally. It's bad for the company. Stop. And that was such an eye opener for me, that yes, you have to help, but no, you don't do other people's jobs, because then they're not happy in their job. I don't want people doing my job. Why would they want me doing their job? It's just, you like this swim lane thing that people talk about is so real. And he taught me that. He at every step of the way, he was guiding me and helping me know
what I. This is an art, though. Pedro, you've talked a lot about this, man. This is an art. Like, if you're too much in your swim lane, then you're detached. So there's an art here to doing. Mm-hmm. I love that he gave you that advice. You know, straight up, like, I love feedback. You know, when it's given in a good way.
Yeah,
I think there's a difference between like isolating yourself in a swim lane, which I hate and have talked about a lot. And I think I don't like the pool analogy. I like the garden analogies our friend Stephanie has come up with, which I think is cool. Like, there are no lanes in a garden, but everybody's sort of doing the thing they're good at or a thing they want to do. But everyone is in view of everyone else in the garden. And there are codependencies across different disciplines in the garden, and there's cooperation. So I love that approach more than swim lanes.
Yep.
But to your point, if today's my day to dig up weeds, and you are standing in front of me and we're both pulling on the same weed, we're going to make a mess out of the garden, right? And so I think, like, understanding, like, playing your position is different than staying in your lane. And I think what I've been told, to this morning, somebody on my team was like, stop emailing that group, because every time you email them, you set off an alarm and it looks like I'm not doing my job. He literally said this to me an hour ago, and he's right, okay? He's right. Yeah. I was just like, I was lost on a substantive issue. And was like, let me just hammer this out and send my note on what I think about it. And he pinged me and said, dude, I agree with you. Just let me do it. You know,
that is so smart. Exactly.
Yeah. And I'm like, yes, okay, that you're right. I missed that shit this morning. And so, you know, I think that, so the mentorship you got was spot on, which is, don't go out there and stick your hand on everybody's keyboard. Like, that is not the move. That does not mean look away from what everybody's doing and just swim as hard as you can in your own little lane.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And so I think that's what you're saying, and I totally agree with.
Yeah. Yeah. I like your analogy much, much better. I'm the one who said swim lanes. Banky didn't.
Everybody said swim lanes. Everybody say it. I say it. I still say it, and I hate it.
But I love that garden analogy. I'm going to start using it. I may not remember to give credit to whoever it is that came up with it. But I'm going to start using it.
Stephanie King. Yeah. Stephanie King.
Stephanie King. I need to meet this Stephanie
I'll send
King.
You a link to her LinkedIn post about the garden. I am obsessed with it because I think it's glorious.
Well, I love that because my favorite thing to do is be in the garden. I only have to work so that I can do it.
I'm not a good gardener, but I try.
Amy, how do you give this or like talk about this with your team? You know, you got to how big is it? First of all, how big is the team? You like another thing, you sort of built a team over time and that wasn't necessarily something you had done in the exact same way before.
Right. Globally, we're, I don't know, about 35 people now. Because we have legal and data ethics separately in the US, and then we keep two separate teams. And then in the rest of the world, they're hybrid. Mm-hmm. And so we have offices in Paris, London, Shanghai.
So how do you do like, I don't want to use the word training necessarily, but how do you like impart to people the stuff that we're just talking about, as opposed to like, yeah, everybody's going to learn the business and they've got people, you know, an onboarding program, I'm sure. But like, how do you do the real stuff?
I believe in, you know, teaching by example, but sometimes talk about it as well. You know, I'll sometimes say to people, look, I don't believe in micromanagement. I believe you get to do what you need to do. And as long as you're doing it well, you may not do it exactly like I do it, but I'm happy that you're doing it well. I will sometimes have to say to this, you know, because again, we're service teams, when I see that our legal or data ethics people seem to me to be, you know, solutioning for product or getting too involved in the weeds of somebody else's issues in the context of doing our legal or data ethics work. I'll remind them. I'll say that's not our job, that we don't have the right to do that. It's their right to do it. I often will, everybody knows Venki, and I'll often reference him and say, you know, this is what I know because this is what Venki taught me, and I know it's right. We need to do that. And it's hard for people to do it. It's really hard because they want to be helpful. They think they know what a good answer is. So kind of the fallback is you can give suggestions. If you've got three ideas, if we have to say no to something, it's good to say it's here's how we can do it instead. You all have talked about this a lot. We all know it. It's just we can't say you have to choose one of these or only say no or only say this is the way you have to do it. Trust them to learn, you know, like if we give them some examples of how they can do it and they think of a better way, hallelujah. That's great.
I would add to that. I think we get further when we explain why we're asking the questions we're asking or why we're thinking the things that we're thinking, because sometimes I feel like lawyers are like, I don't want to bore them with the law or whatever, you know, like, yeah. But instead we should say, I'm asking you about the data sources and where they come from and what country they come from, because the impact is X, Y, Z on that. And the law says this in one sentence, and I want us to build a product that scales. So, you know, and then launch into it. And then I'm always surprised every time I add that little bit of context, lo and behold, shockingly, we have better conversations and we get to better outcomes on things. But we're moving so fast that sometimes it's hard to think and stop and do it.
And also because you forget that other people aren't really thinking like lawyers. That's so easy for me to forget, that things that seem really obvious to me about how we think about things just aren't necessarily to other people. The level of precision that we use in our language or our analysis is different from the way people think about it in sales, or different from the way engineers think about it. Engineers want black and white. I love gray. I'm totally comfortable in it. I have to orient myself a lot to the people that I'm talking to in a way that was less necessary in private practice. In private practice, you're kind of God. They come to you, they're paying you what they think is a lot of money. I now know isn't. But you have so much authority. You don't have that, I find, in the company, which is, you know, distressing. Because I still have the same level of expertise. They just don't appreciate it as much. Or they don't like it as much. I'm constantly thinking to myself, how did that happen?
I wish that someone would refer to me as God in any sort of capacity whatsoever. It's never happened.
In the last 3 minutes, we said hallelujah and I want to be God.
Well, I'm just thinking about my outside counsel, and I'm thinking to myself, like, how they would feel if I treated them like God, you know?
Well, maybe times have changed, I guess. But
well, yeah, that's... I think you had a special – it's very clear you had a special relationship with this company. Like, that's obvious, yeah. And that's not always the case. You know, sometimes the outside counsel is just the transient, person doing work for them.
Yes. You're right. And what I loved about my practice was that I was able to focus on these three companies and spend all my time with them and really get to be part of them. It was wonderful. It just was. And you're right. It probably did give me some different measure of authority, I guess. But I kind of miss having it. That's for sure.
Can I go back a little bit? I noticed, like, you went to boarding school. I was always curious, like, what was that like for you? And do you ever like think about that experience today? And how do you feel about that?
I do, but again, I'm going to show my age here. I went to a boarding school where I was in, I can't remember, I think the second class of boarding girls. It was a boys' school founded in 1789, I think, or 1787. And the tradition was strong. They had let in day girls, so girls from the area who came in during the day, maybe 4 or 5 years before, but not boarding. And so when I got there, this was in 1974, I think.
1974.
Mm-hmm. It was really a boys' school, and the professors, the teachers were all, almost all men. They started to bring in a few women, very few young, who could handle this environment. And they were committed to having girls in the school, but it was not yet fully accomplished, that's for sure. So yeah, I think about that.
Was there an air of excitement? Was there an air of excitement around that? With like the student body?
Yes, but also tension. Yeah, there was excitement, but tension. Not everybody thought we should be there. And those of us who were there, I think, had been handpicked for particular characteristics so that, you know, to fit in, to be part of this beginning. It was a boarding school in probably a kind of English tradition. It was very rigorous physically as well as mentally as well as academically. And it was tiring, you know, like we had classes 6 days a week, and you started at, the first class was probably 7:30 or 8 in the morning, and you finished at 6:30 at night, I think. And then there was a chunk in the afternoon, 4 days a week, when you had either team sports, and then games against other schools on Wednesdays and Saturday afternoons, and you everybody participated in that, and it was just very rigorous. But it was fun. I mean, in retrospect, I loved it. I think I loved it when I was there. I was ready to go away. You know, I was kind of at the age where my father, especially, was sort of driving me crazy. He was, I mean, I obviously got over that because it's a stage, but I was ready to go. And anyway, it was fun. It was really fun. And it was very freeing to start over fresh where nobody knows you and try to, you know, do it right. I was socially awkward for sure. Still, I am socially awkward, but probably got a little bit better with it from that. And I made some very good, nice friends, and I loved a bunch of my professors, and it was a great place.
Wow.
It's really
being socially awkward is highly underrated. I mean, there are limits, right? You don't want to be a creeper, but like having a unique way of experiencing social environments, I think, enriches them. I mean, as long as you're willing to participate, which that can be an awkwardness in and of itself. I think like being in a room full of very different people, and I mean room in a literal and sort of like metaphysical sense, I think is really powerful. I'm always challenging the notion of social awkwardness because I think it has like a pejorative sense. And I think you're pretty cool. And I'm sure you were pretty cool back then. You were probably just not like, you know, run of the mill. And I think that's cool. Yeah. I think that's great.
Well, I don't think that was pretty cool. I think, you know, I think what you're saying is true, but do you understand that when you're a teenager?
No,
and
of course.
How should adults help teenagers understand that? I don't know the answer.
I just wish that our broader system sort of like reinforced the value of having that instead of like pushing the conformity angle, which I can't, you know, it's like, why can't we just create an environment where all sorts of people can participate versus like try to get people to conform? I don't know.
I do.
We should write that book one day.
Quirky people make everything more
interesting. Yeah, I think
that's definitely true.
I'm a big proponent on focusing on neurodiversity. Like that's a thing we need to be focused on heavily. And I like the idea of social interactions as one way to allow everybody to kind of bring themselves and be themselves. And I hope, maybe I'm an eternal optimist. Maybe I am, and maybe it's a fault of mine, but I hope that in corporate America, it feels like it's getting better. It feels like the idea that people can bring different selves or different pieces of themselves to the conversation is getting better. And maybe some of that's remote work or hybrid.
Well, no, Andy, I think you just raised, you raised something that is really interesting and important. Is being remote causing retrogression on this? Bringing your authentic self to work, being with people who are different, doesn't that really happen best when people are in the office together?
I don't know. I think you can make an argument that like distributed work requires lots of people to perform less, me included, by the way. I've been remote for a very long time and I love it because the performance aspect of my job is diminished quite a bit, which is exhausting. And so like, I think distributed work is a great equalizer for lots of people who struggle going into the office, like people with physical disabilities, people with unique cultural expectations and requirements, people who just don't want to be in conference rooms with 10 strangers 10 times a day.
Okay, but I think these are two different things. One is freedom to cope better for the individual. The other is exposing everybody else so that everybody else appreciates it more. When we're not in the office together, do you get enough of that?
I think we have to be intentional. I think we have to be intentional now that it's safe to get together. I think we need to be intentional about getting together. I mean, my company is distributed. We're all over the country. In September, we are all going to California. Like that is intentional and that is purposeful. And we're going to spend days together and we're going to talk about work. We're also going to not talk about work. You know, we're going to socially interact. We're going to do stuff. And so I just think the world's changing and we need to adapt. And I think it's a little bit of this, a little bit of that. It's like, you do have to care and feed the interactions. And so there do have to be everybody building bonds in person is huge and that's never going to go away. But I think day to day, like we have to think through what this is going forward because offices coming back 100%. Like,
and I think we should keep challenging the notion that bond building at work is a requirement for success. There's a large contingent of old white guys who think that. I got it. And that's how they were successful. But it was at the exclusion of many people. And just because me and you might not have anything to bond over because our personal lives are completely different for whatever reasons, doesn't mean we can't work effectively together. And I think creating a little distance allows for that effectiveness because we optimize for people's abilities instead of people's personalities. But you're both right. Like there is an element of trust that comes with knowing someone more than just via email or Zoom. I think that's true, especially when you're doing really hard things. And so I really like your company's approach, Andy, and I'm trying to emulate it here at Meta. Like tomorrow I'm flying to New York and I'm doing an offsite with my team and we're going to hang out for a couple days this week and do some work and do some non-work stuff and just be together. But then on Thursday, everybody's going to fly home and just sort of like get back to their lives. And I think that's perfectly fine. I don't need everybody at my job to be my best friend for me to do a good job. I don't need to be everybody's best friend either. And that doesn't mean we're adversaries. It just means we're coworkers. And that's a type of relationship that I think was like for a long time made to feel like if you didn't think it was a family or a friendship that you weren't being a good corporate steward. I just don't think any of that's true. I hate like family analogies at work. I think that that's insanity.
Well, Amy, well, not like Amy, one of the things you're talking about when you're talking about boarding school, and this is really why why I'm asking is like, you're really with people, you know, it's not like going to the office every day either. It's like, you're living there and you're living with people.
It's more.
And Pedro, you served in the military and, you know, I've been on teams and like, there's something that is really cohesive with experiences like that. So we have to find, that's why I asked Amy, like, I think you have to find like the best of it and pull it out and use it to your advantage as the world changes.
And, you know, for both going to boarding school and being in the military, you know, college too, you're so young. You aren't setting your ways yet. It's the time right. when you're adaptable and formed, being formed. And I hadn't thought about what you're saying, Andy, but it actually makes sense about why it's such an important and strong experience to go away in any of those contexts when you're yeah. so young, because it keeps you from being boxed in a really narrow way. Whether you go when you're 13 or 14 or you go when you're 18, it's still, it's the place where, without even knowing it, without having to think about it, you're learning how not to be the same as you always were. And that's really cool.
There is some distinctions, Andy. Like, I didn't go to boarding school, but like the purpose of boarding school, at least from where I sit, is for the student to consume an education, not to deliver one, right? And so you're learning, you're absorbing, you're there to take from the organization and like shape yourself as a person, as whatever it is. I think the military, you just can't do that remotely. There's just no way. Like to make good decisions in really tense, heated situations, you need to build esprit de corps, right? I don't think you need either one of those things for corporations, right? Like, again, I just think corporations...
Really? Because I think you do.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that like to be a finance guy at Meta, you don't need esprit de corps.
I don't know, Pedro. Let me draw a distinction. Like, I in a vacuum, I don't think you're wrong. I think there's like, no. But I think one difference would be in the last couple jobs, being part of the management team of a smaller company or a growth oriented company, needs are different. Like. You do have to have some of that. Otherwise, it's not that you'll fail and you can't do your job or you won't do your job or you won't get projects done. You might, but is it optimal? Are you really like achieving trust with each other? Trust is on a small group like that, that's making decisions that impact the whole company. So like outside of my realm as GC, it's an interesting distinction for me when you have to act in that capacity of sort of like, yes, I'm a lawyer. I bring legal skills to the table, but like we're talking about a personnel issue that, you know, really is about people and about what we're going to do with people. Yeah. And we're, you know, like, so it's, I do think there's a little bit of a distinction when you change roles a little bit.
I think Andy's point about a big company versus a small one may be really important there too. It also may be individual personality. For me, if I'm not bonded to the people that I work with, if I don't trust them and enjoy them, I have trouble working very effectively. I have trouble working with, it's not that I can't, it's that I don't want to.
Yeah.
I just want to be with people that I like and trust. I like them to be different. I like lots of variety. I like lots of variety of thinking and challenging. But I need to know that they're good people who are smart, who care, and that we get to know each other so that it's just fun to work together. I don't mind it being on Zoom, but I want it to be fun. Or like the job is just too hard to do. It's not fun.
Yeah, I think you guys are saying smart things, and they're good points. I do worry that like a lot of the surfaces on which these bonds are built and this trust is originated, like require a certain like cultural closeness that excludes lots of people. It just does.
I actually think like, the bar is pretty low. I actually think the bar is pretty low, Pedro. I think like,
I don't think so at all.
No, I guess Andy. I mean by that, just to be clear, is like the bar for like what makes a bond in my view is pretty low. Like if I'm, you created, you told me once you created a Slack group at Salesforce for pets, like a couple Slack messages, a couple pictures, doesn't take that much for me to feel like, oh, like we've got this little bond going. All right. Like let's dig in to the trenches. So I think like on the bright side, I do think like, I think remote can work well for bond building.
Yeah. But just to be clear, I guess what I'm suggesting is like, not everybody's personality, and I would argue lots of people's personalities, are not well suited to create the Slack group for pets. Yeah. or even participate in the Slack group for pets. That doesn't make them a lower performer or a less trustworthy person. That makes them a person who is focused on doing whatever their job is and going home to be with their family. And I think like, or going away from the job and doing whatever they do. And I think that's perfectly fine. And like, we optimize and like pivot around this idea of like interaction as a surface for like likability, and then likability translating into trust. Yeah. And I think a lot of that is not that cool, man. I think like I hired you to do a job, not to be my friend. And like, if you do that job really well, whatever it is, I'm going to trust you to do that job. And that's all I need to trust you for. Like that, because we're, if it grows into something better, bigger, cool. If it doesn't, that's not a knock on you. I should still promote you. I should still raise your pay. I should still do all the things. If you don't want to play golf with me and the other partners or whatever it is, because that's not your swag, if you're a tremendous lawyer at the firm, you should become a partner. That's my take.
Well, okay. I think that is a really interesting viewpoint. I wonder if it's realistic given human nature. I would say it suggests that you need to make sure they're more than just golf ways to get to know everybody.
Yeah. I think we're like saying the same stuff. Like, we've got to be really intentional about creating whatever space there is for people to do whatever they need to forge relationships. Right. And it's a round, varied world out there. So
and as we move into tying this back to our work, right? Like, as like our work impacts more people, which it does now, as AI by definition like exponentially raises the stakes around privacy and data protection, the three of us, but the entire profession, has to be really intentional about not letting it be so that the same people who have dominated the conversation, not on purpose, I don't think they set out to dominate the conversation, but that those same voices are not the ones creating the future for this profession in the context of these new technologies.